Good morning, Cedarville University. You are an impressive sight. It's wonderful to be here, letting my colleagues manage deadlines. You guys have taken a great risk having a journalist in an election season from a crazy right magazine. And that, quite literally, is a quote from a Clinton email about World Magazine. But we're not here to talk politics. I want to thank Dr. White and members of the faculty and administration for having me here. I want to thank you for being in your chairs and on this beautiful morning. The first time I came to Cedarville, it was gale force winds and driving. I rode in a golf cart with Dr. White. We had plastic on all three sides, and we still got wet. So I think that was my initiation, and I'm thankful for a beautiful day. But suppose, just suppose, on this beautiful day, that we were on the verge of a global conflagration. Suppose, for instance, a war began again in Iraq, a country that has been at war almost nonstop since 1980, a country with the world's fifth largest proven oil reserves, the oldest civilization, and the oldest artifacts in the world. Suppose that was all threatened. Suppose it was invaded by a raging militant army, the kind of unthinkable madmen who dunk Christians and drown them to death in vats of water in a church courtyard, who set them in cages, set them on fire in cages, or haul them out into the desert to behead them. Suppose they raped girls as young as 8 or 10. Suppose they kidnapped, tortured, and held for 18 months a young American aid worker your age. And we in America, and we, our White House, did nothing. Suppose that happened. Suppose all this were happening in front of you. Not just hearsay, not just something somebody told you about, not something buried in tiny print at the back of a newspaper, but suppose what I'm describing was videotaped, broadcast, right here into the palm of your hand. Suppose that happened. I don't have to tell you that what we are supposing, that the nightmare scenarios are reality. It's the world that we are living in on Monday morning, October 17th, 2016. I'm a child of the 20th century, and this is not the 21st century I dreamed of. We've all seen the images of the men in orange jumpsuits. We've seen the beheadings, haven't we? We've seen the Syrian boy washed up on the shore. We've seen the Syrian boy in the ambulance. Perhaps overnight you saw the videotape of the Syrian boy dangling from a bombed-out apartment building and a cherry picker trying to get close enough through the rubble to rescue him. From these two small countries in the Middle East, and they are truly small, look on a globe if you haven't recently, are streaming millions of refugees, part of the worst refugee crisis since World War II. And last night, Iraq launched a long-awaited assault on Mosul to take back its own city, second largest city, one of the oldest cities in the world, that was captured by ISIS in 2014, 2 years ago. It's not an exaggeration to say that in Syria and Iraq, we have the makings of a global conflagration, It could become the world war of our lives, of your generation. It could become the war that our American leaders for three generations have worked to build a security framework against, that our international bodies have pledged to avoid. ISIS has suffered defeats, and we can pray that ISIS will be defeated in Mosul. I heard a report this morning from one of the Assyrian priests just outside of Mosul. The Kurdish forces have advanced overnight 6 miles in across Nineveh Plains. They have even now already retaken 12 villages that were mostly Christian villages. Those are villages that are mostly destroyed now, but still, this is an accomplishment. But I want to say, at the risk of sounding like a pessimist, which I'm not, I hope you'll come to see, that ISIS has declared provinces now in these 2 years that we've been watching this unfold. ISIS has declared provinces in 11 countries around the world. From more than 10 countries, it has drawn 30,000 foreign fighters into Iraq and Syria. That is more foreign fighters than ever showed up in Afghanistan in 10 years of war. Today, nearly all of Iraq's Christian population is displaced. Nearly all. Many of them are huddled in northern Iraq in the area known as Kurdistan. Many of them have fled the country altogether. Many of them are refugees in Turkey, a country that is right now detaining 2 American Christian workers, not a safe place to be. And the response from our political leaders, I don't think I have to tell you, has ranged from faltering to incoherent. In Iraq, the United States is fighting ISIS alongside the government. In Syria, the United States is fighting ISIS and the government. We are sharing airspace in a place maybe about the size of Ohio with the Russians and the Turks and the Syrians and the Saudis and some others. Everyone claims to be fighting ISIS, and ISIS keeps holding more than 3,000 Yazidi women, a number of Christians also among them, Yazidi women and girls, and more than 1,400 civilians have been killed in Syria in the last year, in the last 3 weeks. Our major presidential candidates have denigrated or ignored refugees. They have dubbed 6 million of them, because that's how many of them there have been from Syria. Not worth our time. But I'm here today not only to paint this bleak picture and to ruin your week right at the outset. I'm here to help you, I hope, understand perhaps a little bit more of how we got here and why in this scene, there's any reason at all to have hope and expectation, because I do have hope and I do have expectations for good things to come in so colossal a breakdown. 8 months after the Iraq war began, the one that began in 2003, that is, the war of U.S.-led liberation, I flew into Baghdad with an Iraqi woman named Insaf Safu. I was the American. I was quite simply a reporter going to cover a war, and Insaf to me was going to be emblematic of how Iraqis were doing in that war. She and her husband had been chased out by Saddam Hussein's regime 9 years before, forced into exile, given asylum in Canada, and now she was returning for the first time. Keep in mind, no FaceTime, no Facebook, no Skype, no YouTube. So she'd had no contact, no visible contact with her family in those 9 years. Insof would turn out to be more than I bargained for. She was a Christian, and she was fearless. And through her, I would begin to see Iraq in ways that were different from what we were learning in the headlines. I would begin to see a diversity that was beyond my imagining. I lived for a week with a Christian family in a Muslim neighborhood of Baghdad, and I saw how this cradle of civilization, this land we once called Mesopotamia, had been host to all of these religious traditions, and how they had learned to, for better and for worse, to coexist. When we think of the Holy Land, we think of Israel, right? I think we think of Israel. Yet consider from our Old Testament that the stories of Noah, of Abraham, prophets Jonah, Nahum, Daniel, and a few others, their stories are all set in what was Mesopotamia, what is now modern-day Iraq, and that upper Euphrates Valley that constitutes Syria, Turkey, and northern Iraq right now, this area that is seeing so much fighting. Iraq's Christian roots and Syria's go back to nearly the time of Christ and to the earliest era of Christianity. The Assyrians and later the Babylonians, we know, carried the Jewish people into captivity. But God had given the Jews a few instructions on being strangers and exiles, hadn't he? And over the centuries, the Jewish people actually established a remarkable life for themselves in Babylon that is not fully told in Scripture, our Scripture. The Jewish academies that sprang up near modern-day Fallujah, a city that we've heard a lot about, a city that was recently retaken from ISIS, produced the best translations of Jewish law. If you talk to a rabbi in Brooklyn, he is using the Babylonian Talmud to teach his classes today. At the time of Jesus Christ's life, more Jews lived outside what we think of as the Holy Land or Israel than inside it, and at least 1 million Jews lived in Babylon. 1 million. Such a Jewish center would become a natural place for followers of Jesus. In the second century after Christ's birth and life, a bishop from southern Turkey traveled across this region, and he wrote, "Everywhere I found Christians with whom to speak." So in 2003, I discovered this living and breathing church. I found worship happening in Aramaic, the language of Jesus, and I found it happening in little rooms with plastic chairs and Yamaha keyboards, and they were singing praise songs I recognized, only they were in Arabic. I met ethnic Christians with long ties to their faith, and I met new believers, converts from Islam. And so I returned. This area was fascinating to me, and I would return again and again to chronicle the stories of the Iraqis, having no idea how long their journey was going to be. I faced some cultural gaps, as you might imagine. At one point, or actually this happened multiple times, I'm in my 40s and I'm in meetings and somebody would lean across and look at me and say, "Does your father know you're here?" And that's a wonderful piece of Arab hospitality and protection I had to understand and come to learn. By 2006, I would know several pastors who had been killed in targeted bombings, kidnappings, or killings. Insof's cousin and his son would be killed in a bombing. And an Assyrian priest at the end of that year would hand me a tally of the list of all the Christians who had been killed or kidnapped, and it was 24 pages long, 2006. What was becoming clear as this was happening, and we weren't hearing about it, were we? Is that our U.S. political leaders had determined not to see the diversity of Iraq that I was discovering, and they were determined to counter a religious threat by appearing deaf to its fervor. We have asked our brothers and sisters in Christ in this part of the world to pay dearly for ignoring the religious dimensions of that conflict. One of the things that became clear is that there would be no special protection for Iraq's Christians. And as a result of that, no special protection for other minorities, like the Yazidis, the Mandians, the Shabak. Iraq's Christian population, as a result, has declined by 80% since the start of the U.S.-led war in 2003, from about 1.2 million Christians to less than 225,000. I think even since that number came out, it's dropped considerably. And yet somehow in those years, I began to think of my travels to Iraq and Syria as journeys to find water in the desert. How in the world would that be possible? But here's what I was seeing. The greater the danger, the more brutal the persecution, the more the Christians shined in their witness. They could not trust their political leaders or big countries sent to help them, like the United States. They had to look to God alone and to one another. This may be a future that we in the United States as Christians come to appreciate more and more. When Jesus Christ is your reality, you are following someone who has walked into death so that others might have life and might have life abundantly and everlastingly. Life out of death, out of the most brutal and unjust circumstances, can become the theme of your song. And this is what I saw happening among the Christians. My friend Ensof would return over and over again, and she would begin to help women establish ministries in their churches. They would minister to women in prison, mostly Muslims. They would minister to one another. These have become vital networks since all of this displacement and war with ISIS, to helping traumatized women, women who've been freed from ISIS captivity, in fact. A Christian pastor named Yusuf Mahdi. Some of you may have heard of Yusuf. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that all of these people are standing up out there on the plains in Iraq. They're only 10, 15 miles from ISIS front lines, and they're happy to be named. They're very prominent. They're very active in their communities. Yusuf Mahdi has helped to start 3 schools across Iraq, and after all of this happened in 2014, he was the first, he beat the UN in opening a school for Yazidi children in a refugee camp, a UN-run refugee camp. That school, I was there on opening day, and it opened with 350 Yazidi students. One of the moms told me they had been given backpacks for the opening day, and one of the moms told me that her children couldn't get to sleep that night. They were so excited about their backpacks. Imagine, they lost everything, and a backpack is pretty special. So that school opened in 2015 with 350 students. By that afternoon, it had 700, and by about 2 days later, it had 2,000. And that's because the Arab superintendent of the schools in Mosul came to Yusuf Mahdi and said, "Would you take in our children too?" So consider a whole education system also displaced. And so here you have the Muslim majority coming to the Christian pastor and saying, "Would you help us educate our children?" This, my friends, is water in the desert. I began to think of the persecuted church more as a persevering church, and I'd like you to think of it that way too. Besides wanting to chronicle what was happening, I began to ask, is there something for us to learn in this colossal breakdown? The Christians in Iraq, across many traditions and styles of worship, in Aramaic, in Arabic, in Kurdish, and other languages, have come together in many ways around the gospel and around the fellowship of suffering. So two things in conclusion. Actually, maybe a couple more than two. You know the story of Kayla Mueller. I alluded to it in the beginning. Captured, died in captivity, brutally tortured. If you saw that ABC segment, I can't remember which show, you saw just some amazing testimony coming from fellow humanitarian workers who saw her in an exchange with her ISIS captors. She was, they were bragging that she had converted to Islam. And keep in mind, a couple of them had been hung by chains from their toes. She had been raped repeatedly. She had been tortured physically in other ways. And when these ISIS commanders are bragging that she's converted to Islam, she stood up and she said, no, I haven't. This is your generation. This is the other reason I have hope. Your generation is a brave generation and a generation that I see in remarkable ways putting first things first. Kayla Mueller also, when she went to work in Syria, said, as just as all of these things began unfolding, she said, "For as long as I live, I will not let this suffering be normal." And I want to challenge you, the things that we've described today, the things that we know are happening, the things that are coming to us on our phone, don't let them become normal. I want to encourage you by the example, and I want to end with my friend Antoine Audo. He is the Chaldean Archbishop of Aleppo. I am thankful to say is, because two of his counterparts in the Syriac Orthodox Church and the another Orthodox Church, who I also came to know quite well during the war years, the U.S. war years, both were kidnapped and are presumed dead. Antoine Audo is in many ways the last man standing among the church leaders in Aleppo. And he has persisted in organizing food for Christians and Muslims and anyone in need and feeding them every day in this horrible besieged city. A few months ago, he said this. He said, "The anarchy of war allows you to perceive in even greater terms the greatness of human dignity just when it seems so humiliated." Let's not forget the steady greatness of human dignity, the God-created dignity in every one of us that is beneath the noise of this war. And let's not forget the persevering church, which has so much to teach us. They need our prayers, they need our support, they need our help, they need our political leaders to care and to be wise. But we need them too, because they have so much to teach us. These Christians, in losing everything, and being forced away from everything they had known, held on to the one thing that mattered most, and that is their faith. Thank you.